Chapter 115. In which the same subject is pursued, Becky did not rally from the state of stupor and confusion in which the events of the previous night had plunged her intrepid spirit until the bells of the Curzon Street chapels were ringing for afternoon service, and rising from her bed she began to ply her own bell, in order to summon the French maid who had left her some hours before. Mrs. Rawdon Crawley rang many times in vain, and though, on the last occasion, she rang with such vehemence as to pull down the bell rope, Mademoiselle Fiffin did not make her appearance, no, not though her mistress, in a great pet, and with the bell rope in her hand, came out to the landing place with her hair over her shoulders, and screamed out repeatedly for her attendant. The truth is, as he had quitted the premises for many hours, and upon that permission which is called French leave among us, after picking up the trinkets, in the drawing room, Mademoiselle had ascended to her own apartments, packed and corded her own boxes there, tripped out and called a cab for herself, brought down her trunks with her own hand, and without ever so much as asking the aid of any of the other servants, who would probably have refused it, as they hated her cordially, and without wishing any one of them goodbye, had made her exit from Curzon Street. The game, in her opinion, was over in that little domestic establishment. Fiffin went off in a cab, as we have known more exalted persons of her nation to do under similar circumstances. But, more provident or lucky than these, she secured not only her own property, but some of her mistress's, if indeed that lady could be said to have any property at all, and not only carried off the trinkets before alluded to, and some favorite dresses on which she had long kept her eye, but four richly gilt Louis Quatorze candlesticks, six gilt albums, keepsakes, and books of beauty, a gold enameled snuff box which had once belonged to Madame Du Barry, and the sweetest little inkstand and mother of pearl blotting book, which Becky used when she composed her charming little pink notes, had vanished from the premises in Curzon Street together with Mademoiselle Fiffin, and all the silver laid on the table for the little festin which Rawdon interrupted. The plated ware Mademoiselle left behind her was too cumbrous, probably for which reason, no doubt, she also left the fire irons, the chimney glasses, and the rosewood cottage piano. A lady very like her subsequently kept a milliner's shop in the Rue du Helder at Paris, where she lived with great credit, and enjoyed the patronage of my Lord Steyne. This person always spoke of England as of the most treacherous country in the world, and stated to her young pupils that as he had been affrucement vole by natives of that island, it was no doubt compassion for her misfortunes which induced the Marquis of Steyne to be so very kind to Madame de Saint Amaranth. May she flourish as she deserves, she appears no more in our quarter of Vanity Fair. Hearing a buzz and a stir below, and indignant at the impudence of those servants who would not answer her summons, Mrs. Crawley flung her morning robe round her, and descended majestically to the drawing room, whence the noise proceeded. The cook was there with blackened face, seated on the beautiful chintz sofa by the side of Mrs. Raggles, to whom she was administering maraschino. The page with the sugar loaf buttons, who carried about Becky's pink notes, and jumped about her little carriage with such alacrity, was now engaged putting his fingers into a cream dish. The footman was talking to Raggles, who had a face full of perplexity and woe, and yet, though the door was open, and Becky had been screaming a half dozen of times a few feet off, not one of her attendants had obeyed her call. Ave a little drop, die now, Mrs. Raggles, the cook was saying as Becky entered, the white cashmere dressing gown flouncing around her. Simpson! Trotter! The mistress of the house cried in great wrath. How dare you stay here, when you heard me call? How dare you sit down in my presence? Where's my maid? The page withdrew his fingers from his mouth with a momentary terror, but the cook took off a glass of maraschino, of which Mrs. Raggles had had enough, staring at Becky over the little gilt glass as she drained its contents. The liquor appeared to give the odious rebel courage. "You're Sophie, indeed," Mrs. Cook said. "A may settin' on Mrs. Raggles' Sophie. Don't you stir, Mrs. Raggles, Mum. I may set on Mr. and Mrs. Raggles' Sophie, which they bought with honest money, and very dear it cost them too. And I'm thinking, if I set here until I'm paid my wages, I shall set a precious long time, Mrs. Raggles, and set I will, too, ha, ha. And with this, she filled herself another glass of the liquor, and drank it with a more hideously satirical air. Trotter! Simpson! Turn that drunken wretch out, screamed Mrs. Crawley. I shan't, said Trotter the footman. Turn out yourself. Pay our salaries, and turn me out too. We'll go fast enough. Are you all here to insult me? Cried Becky in a fury. When Colonel Crawley comes home I'll... At this the servants burst into a hoarse ha-ha, in which, however, Raggles, who still kept a most melancholy countenance, did not join. He ain't a coming back, Mr. Trotter resumed. He sent for his things, and I wouldn't let him go, although Mr. Raggles would. And I don't believe he's no more a colonel than I am. He's off, and I suppose you're a going after him. You're no better than swindlers, both on you. Don't be a bullying me. I won't stand it. Pay us our salaries, I say. Pay us our salaries. It was evident, from Mr. Trotter's flushed countenance and defective intonation, that he too, had had recourse to vinous stimulus. Mr. Raggles, said Becky in a passion of vexation, you will not surely let me be insulted by that drunken man? H. Hold your noise, Trotter. Do now, said Simpson the page. He was affected by his mistress's deplorable situation, and succeeded in preventing an outrageous denial of the epithet drunken on the footman's part. Oh, ma'am, said Raggles, I never thought to live to see this here day. I've known the Crawley family ever since I was born. I lived butler with Miss Crawley for 30 years. And I little thought one of that family was a going to ruin me, yes, ruin me, said the poor fellow with tears in his eyes. Are you a going to pay me? You've lived in this house 4 years. You've had my substance, my plate and linen. You owe me a milk and butter bill of £200. You must have a new laid eggs for your omelets, and cream for your spaniel dog. She didn't care what her own flesh and blood had, interposed the cook. Any's the time, he'd have starved but for me. He's a charity boy now, Cookie, said Mr. Trotter, with a drunken ha, ha. And honest Raggles continued, in a lamentable tone, an enumeration of his griefs. All he said was true. Becky and her husband had ruined him. He had bills coming due next week, and no means to meet them. He would be sold up and turned out of his shop and his house, because he had trusted to the Crawley family. His tears and lamentations made Becky more peevish than ever. You all seem to be against me, she said bitterly. W, what do you want? I can't pay you on Sunday. Come back tomorrow, and I'll pay you everything. I thought Colonel Crawley had settled with you. He will tomorrow. I declare to you upon my honor that he left home this morning with £1,500 in his pocketbook. He has left me nothing. Apply to him. Give me a bonnet and shawl, and let me go out and find him. There was a difference between us this morning. You all seem to know it. I promise you upon my word that you shall all be paid. He has got a good appointment. Let me go out and find him. This audacious statement caused Raggles and the other personages present to look at one another with a wild surprise, and with it Rebecca left them. She went upstairs, and dressed herself this time without the aid of her French maid. She went into Rawdon's room, and there saw that a trunk and bag were packed ready for removal, with a pencil direction that they should be given when called for. Then she went into the Frenchwoman's garret. Everything was clean, and all the drawers emptied there. She bethought herself of the trinkets which had been left on the ground and felt certain that the woman had fled. Gee, good heavens! Was ever such ill luck as mine? She said, to be so near, and to lose all. Is it all too late? No, there was one chance more. She dressed herself, and went away unmolested this time, but alone. It was 4 o'clock. She went swiftly down the streets as he had no money to pay for a carriage, and never stopped until she came to Sir Pitt Crawley's door in Great Gaunt Street. Where was Lady Jane Crawley? She was at church. Becky was not sorry. Sir Pitt was in his study, and had given orders not to be disturbed. She must see him. She slipped by the sentinel in livery at once, and was in Sir Pitt's room before the astonished baronet had even laid down the paper. He turned red, and started back from her with a look of great alarm and horror. "Do not look so," she said. "I'm not guilty, Pitt, dear Pitt. You were my friend once. Before God, I am not guilty. I seem so. Everything is against me. And oh, at such a moment, just when all my hopes were about to be realized, just when happiness was in store for us. Is this true, what I see in the paper then?" Sir Pitt said a paragraph in which had greatly surprised him. "It is true. Lord Stang told me on Friday night, the night of that fatal ball. He has been promised an appointment any time these 6 months. Mr. Martyr, the colonial secretary, told him yesterday that it was made out. That unlucky arrest ensued. That horrible meeting. I was only guilty of too much devotedness to rotten service. I have received Lord Stang alone 100 times before. I confess I had money of which Rodden knew nothing. Don't you know how careless he is of it, and could I dare to confide it to him?" And so she went on with a perfectly connected story, which she poured into the ears of her perplexed kinsman. It was to the following effect. Becky owned, and with perfect frankness, but deep contrition, that having remarked Lord Stang's partiality for her at the mention of which Pitt blushed, and being secure of her own virtue, as he had determined to turn the great peer's attachment to the advantage of herself and her family. "Looked for a peerage for you, Pitt," she said. The brother-in-law again turned red. "We have talked about it. Your genius and Lord Stang's interest made it more than probable, had not this dreadful calamity come to put an end to all our hopes. But, first, I own that it was my object to rescue my dear husband, him whom I love in spite of all his ill usage and suspicions of me, to remove him from the poverty and ruin which was impending over us. I saw Lord Stang's partiality for me," she said, casting down her eyes. "Own that I did everything in my power to make myself pleasing to him, and as far as an honest woman may, to secure his esteem. It was only on Friday morning that the news arrived of the death of the governor of Coventry Island, and my lord instantly secured the appointment for my dear husband. It was intended as a surprise for him. He was to see it in the papers today. Even after that horrid arrest took place, the expenses, of which Lord Stang generously said he would settle, so that I was in a manner prevented from coming to my husband's assistance. My lord was laughing with me, and saying that my dearest Rodden would be consoled, when he read of his appointment in the paper, in that shocking spun bailiff's house. And then he came home. His suspicions were excited. The dreadful scene took place between my lord and my cruel, cruel Rodden, and, oh my God, what will happen next? Pitt, dear Pitt, pity me, and reconcile us." And as she spoke, she flung herself down on her knees, and bursting into tears, seized hold of Pitt's hand, which she kissed passionately. It was in this very attitude that Lady Jane, who, returning from church, ran to her husband's room directly she heard Mrs. Rodden Crawley was closeted there, found the baronet and his sister-in-law. "I am surprised that woman has the audacity to enter this house," Lady Jane said, trembling in every limb and turning quite pale. Her ladyship had sent out her maid directly after breakfast, who had communicated with Raggles and Rodden Crawley's household, who had told her all, and a great deal more than they knew, of that story, and many others besides. How dare Mrs. Crawley, to enter the house of an honest family? Sir Pitt started back, amazed at his wife's display of vigor. Becky still kept her kneeling posture, and clung to Sir Pitt's hand. "Tell her that she does not know all. Tell her that I am innocent, dear Pitt," she whimpered out. "Upon my word, My love, I think you do Mrs. Crawley injustice, Sir Pitt said, at which speech Rebecca was vastly relieved. Indeed, I believe her to be what? Cried out Lady Jane, her clear voice thrilling, and her heart beating violently as she spoke. To be a wicked woman, a heartless mother, a false wife? She never loved her dear little boy, who used to fly here and tell me of her cruelty to him. She never came into a family, but she strove to bring misery with her, and to weaken the most sacred affections with her wicked flattery and falsehoods. As he has deceived her husband, as he has deceived everybody, her soul is black with vanity, worldliness, and all sorts of crime. I tremble when I touch her. I keep my children out of her sight. Lady Jane, cried Sir Pitt, starting up, this is really language. I have been a true and faithful wife to you, Sir Pitt, Lady Jane continued, intrepidly. I have kept my marriage vow as I made it to God, and have been obedient and gentle as a wife should. But righteous obedience has its limits, and I declare that I will not bear that woman again under my roof. If she enters it, I and my children will leave it. She is not worthy to sit down with Christian people. You must choose, sir, between her and me. And with this my lady swept out of the room, fluttering with her own audacity, and leaving Rebecca and Sir Pitt not a little astonished at it. As for Becky, she was not hurt. Nay, she was pleased. It was the diamond clasp you gave me, she said to Sir Pitt, reaching him out her hand. And before she left him, for which event you may be sure my Lady Jane was looking out from her dressing room window in the upper story, the baronet had promised to go and seek out his brother, and endeavor to bring about a reconciliation. Rawdon found some of the young fellows of the regiment seated in the mess room at breakfast, and was induced without much difficulty to partake of that meal, and of the deviled legs of fowls and soda water with which these young gentlemen fortified themselves. Then they had a conversation befitting the day and their time of life, about the next pigeon match at Battersea, with relative bets upon Ross and Espeldiston, about Mademoiselle Arion of the French opera, and who had left her, and how she was consoled by Panther Carr, and about the fight between the butcher and the pet, and the probabilities that it was a cross. Young Tandyman, a hero of 17, laboriously endeavoring to get up a pair of mustachios, had seen the fight, and spoke in the most scientific manner about the battle, and the condition of the men. It was he who had driven the butcher onto the ground in his drag, and passed the whole of the previous night with him. Had there not been foul play, he must have won it. All the old files of the ring were in it, and Tandyman wouldn't pay. No, damme, he wouldn't pay. It was but a year since the young cornet, now so knowing a hand in Cribb's parlor, had a still lingering liking for toffee, and used to be birched at Eton. So they went on talking about dancers, fights, drinking, demireps, until McMurdo came down, and joined the boys and the conversation. He did not appear to think that any especial reverence was due to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.